Hi, Ashley.
Hi, Hisham. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Doing well.
So let's start with the introductions.
Okay.
I'm Hisham A. Hellier. I'm fellow at the University of Warwick and director of the Visionary Consultants Group. And my writings on the Middle East in various Western and Arab world press can be found at www.hahellier.com.
Okay. My name is Ashley McCarr. I am a freelance writer and co-editor of the magazine of religion and culture called KillingTheBuddha.com, www.killingthebuddha.com. And I'm also a graduate student at Yale Divinity School, also studying, focusing on religion and culture.
Nice to meet you, Ashley.
Great to meet you, too. I know you've done a lot of work on the role of religion in the revolution in Egypt, as well as the uprisings in Libya, and I would please share your impressions of that. I'd love to talk more with you about that.
Well, it's interesting that people talked a lot about religion in the context of Egypt and Libya over the past sort of few weeks, because really on the ground within Egypt, the role of religious authority, as opposed to religion in particular, but religious authority really didn't have very much to say on how the uprising began, how it continued, and how it ended with the stepping down of Hosni Mubarak, and within Libya, how it continues now with the uprising against Muammar Gaddafi. That said, I think that religion in general has definitely played something of a role in terms of mobilizing people. So you had different scholars from within the Azhar establishment, which is the main religious establishment in Egypt, come out with religious verdicts that said that it was a very good thing for people to be involved in the protests, the religious term being fard al-kifaya, which meant a communal obligation as opposed to an individual personal one.
A communal obligation to resist oppression?
No, as opposed to a personal obligatory duty. So you have within Islamic law the two different types of obligations. One one is personally obligatory, so prayer, for example, is personally obligatory, and then communally obligatory, which refers to a duty that falls upon the community as a whole, such that if a section of the community takes up that obligation, and the rest of the community is absolved of trying to do that thing.
Okay.
So, for example, establishing the funeral prayer for passed away Muslims, for example. So you definitely had those sorts of statements going on. You also had a number of graduates from the Al-Azhar University present in Tahrir Square, making supplications and leading people in prayers and so on. And people were praying in Tahrir Square.
I know that there were, you know, there were prayers for the people who died in the revolution, both Christians and Muslims joining in prayer in Tahrir Square.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this is another thing that I think was very significant about Tahrir Square, that the spirit of religious cooperation was very, very strong. And it didn't just extend to offering prayers for the deceased, but it also extended to ensuring that during the Friday prayers of the Muslims, Coptic Christians would encircle them in order to protect them from any harm that might befall them. And during the masses that took place on Sundays, the same would happen in reverse. So you see that was very much a part of what Tahrir Square was, and the spirit of cooperation, I think, has remained and will probably continue to remain. That all said, there were also parts of the religious establishment within Egypt that were not particularly in favor of the protests at all, which testifies to the almost irrelevance on the ground to the lives of the people, because otherwise the people wouldn't have really gone to Tahrir Square. Even
and you're speaking of the Muslim religious establishment?
No, I'm speaking of both.
Because I heard that Pope Shenouda advised people not to participate.
This is correct. So Pope Shenouda of the Coptic Church was very clear quite early on mm-hmm. in his, I don't think it would have been interpreted as, well, I'm sure it was interpreted on the ground here as personal support from Hosni Mubarak, but from the point of view of the church, I'm sure there was on the basis of fear of the unknown and security and stability and all mm-hmm. the rest of it, which was very similar to how I suspect some members of the Muslim religious establishment were also perceiving the situation. Having said all of that, their statements generally fell on quite deaf ears, mm-hmm. And people weren't particularly interested in listening to those sorts of statements and taking them in anything but support for the regime.
Right.
So in that regard, religious authority proved itself to be very much disconnected from the people on the ground, and in practical purposes, fairly irrelevant. Having said all of that, there were definitely people who came from both religious establishments who were present at Tahrir and remained at Tahrir, and continue to be very much involved with people on the ground, but they did so without being quote-unquote authorized by the religious leadership of those institutions, mm-hmm. the Coptic Church or the Azhar University. I think that that's just a matter of historical record now.
Mm.
I think it means more for the Coptic community than it does for the Muslim community because of the position that the Coptic Pope has in terms of religious authority in the church, as opposed to, you know, the Sheikh al-Azhar or the head of the University of the Azhar, who doesn't occupy quite the same role as far as the Muslim community at large is concerned. And that's
meaning that Pope Shenouda has more authority over people's choices than the Sheikh from
Azhar? Well, I wouldn't put it as people's choices, but the role and position of the Coptic Pope within church doctrine is very different than
right.
the role and position of Sheikh al-Azhar
mm-hmm.
in the Azhar University, or for that matter, the Mufti of Egypt or anybody else. And that comes down to a real difference in terms of how religious authority in these two different traditions is interpreted and established,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is natural, and you know that's just the way the history has worked itself out. Within Libya, it's a very different situation. In terms of the fact that the religious establishment in Libya seems to have come out extremely strongly in support of the uprising, not just protests, but uprising
mm-hmm.
against Muammar Gaddafi. So even at the height of the uprising within Egypt, the religious establishment, even those parts of the religious establishment that were in favor of the protests, nobody was declaring themselves as openly supportive of armed rebellion against the state.
Right.
Of course, nobody was calling for that either, but nobody from the religious establishment was particularly interested in, you know, supporting that even from a theological permissibility perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is very different in Libya. In Libya, to begin with, the various parts of the religious establishment seem to have come out quite strongly in support of the right of protesters to protest. They came out with strong critiques of the regime when the regime started, you know, cracking down. And once the situation went beyond a certain point, they actually called for the regime to be removed and removed by force if necessary.
Okay, so
which is
implying that if violence is necessary, then that
I don't think it was. I don't think it was by implication. I think
okay.
it was very explicit.
Okay.
I think that this is very clear in terms of the makeup of the Libyan opposition to Gaddafi
mm-hmm.
right now. And this isn't entirely unexpected, but was a little bit sort of out of the ordinary. It's almost unprecedented within this region, as a lot of things happen to be at the moment unprecedented,
mm.
That a religious establishment would actually call for violence against the state for whatever reason. For
right.
whatever reason. But in this case, it seems to have been very well received by the people who deemed the religious establishment in Libya to be on the side of the people, as opposed to being on the side of the regime.
Mm-hmm.
Something that I don't think was quite so pronounced within Egypt.
Mm-hmm. And would you say, I know very little about sort of religiosity in Libya. Would you say that that was more that the process in Libya was largely a secular movement, but having the support of the religious authorities was sort of just a greater motivation, or was there, would you say that there was more of a religious element in the protests in Libya?
I think it's probably somewhere in between. The the society of Libya is not more religious, I would assume and surmise, than the general society in Egypt, for example. Maybe a little bit, but we're not talking about huge amounts of religiosity as compared to Egypt. I think the biggest difference between the two would be the fact that the Libyan religious establishment comes out of a tradition of resistance to tyranny in a martial kind of way. So you notice that a lot of pro-Libyan activists on the internet have put one of two things. They've either put the flag of Libya as it was before Muammar Gaddafi took over, or they put a picture of a white-haired bearded man. That white-haired bearded man is Omar al-Mukhtar, who is the resistance leader of Libya against the fascists of Italy in the 20th century.
So it's a very nationalist sentiment.
Well, nationalist in one sense, but also religious, because Omar Mukhtar was he was a resistance fighter, but he was also a sheikh of a Sufi order and a recognized religious authority who refused to accept that Italy had any legitimacy in Libya. And he died even while Libya was under occupation. But his memory seems to have continued within Libya even until today. It's very interesting that the Sufi order that he followed is the same Sufi order that that those who founded Libya belonged to. And the flag of Libya pre-Muammar Gaddafi was actually the flag that represented the regime founded by members of that order, the Sanusi order. So there are those religious undertones, I think, that exist within Libyan society and that have a relationship to that kind of resistance against tyranny. It hasn't obviously, resulted in anything happening for the past 20 or so years. But I think that once violence from the state got past a certain point, that kind of reactivated that impulse to self-defense. We'll see how that all plays out. But I think that those are really the key differences here, that the tradition of the Libyan religious establishment is somewhat different than that of Egypt. Egypt obviously had a colonial period, but the uprising again, or the independence movement didn't take the same form as it did in Libya.
Right, it was very Arab nationalist. In Egypt.
The Libyans were also very acutely aware of their Arab identity, but I think that one of the main differences was that there was a guerrilla resistance movement against the fascism of the Italians that were ruling Libya at the time. And you don't really have that kind of memory within Egypt in that same way at all.
Memory of the religious establishment being more involved in political activism and resistance.
Political activism through resistance in that kind of way. I mean, obviously there are different religious movements that have been active in Egypt for many years and many decades that do get involved in politics. But there's a difference between that and what was essentially a guerrilla resistance movement led by Omar al-Mukhtar.
Yeah, and as we should speak about the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, because that is, many people are curious about, projections of what role the Muslim Brotherhood played in the revolution in Egypt, as well as what role they will play in the future. I do know that there was a lot of fear among Americans and also among Egyptian Christians about the role of the Muslim Brotherhood. And, it seems like they have been somewhat hands off, participating in the revolution, but also, saying that they would not participate in the elections in September. And I don't know, what are your impressions of that?
Well, the Brotherhood is less of an ideological organization now and has been for quite some time, and much more of a pragmatic one. So mm-hmm. during the initial beginnings of the January 25th uprising and the dawn of the revolution, the Brotherhood really went to great pains to distance themselves from being associated with the leadership of the uprising.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't really a leadership at the time, but they made sure that everybody knew that it wasn't them,
right.
Including the government. They made that very, very clear and mm-hmm. said, look, you know exactly who's behind all of these protests. It's not us, so don't blame us for it, because this isn't us at all. Our youth have gotten involved as Egyptian youth. They haven't mm-hmm. gotten involved as Ikhwani or Muslim Brotherhood youth.
Right.
And they made that very clear. As the days went on and they were invited to become part of the negotiation sort of team, then that changed somewhat, but they still tended to take a back seat, partly because I think that they knew that they don't speak for the majority of Egyptians.
Mm-hmm.
They do have a voice in Egypt, which is why the regime wanted to bring them into the equation, to be able to show that, you know, it wasn't going to be business as usual, it was going to be something a little bit different.
Right.
But in terms of their influence and their role, I don't think it was just, you know, Americans or Egyptian Christians who were concerned about it, but pretty much anyone in Egypt who isn't a supporter of the Brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
But in that regard, they don't really figure more prominently, I would say, than really any other political party.
Mm-hmm.
The difference with the Muslim Brotherhood is that they are far more organized than any other political party that exists in Egypt after the fall of Hosni Mubarak, because they've had so long to try to build themselves up as a civil society force. And they were probably
right.
one of the only civil society forces that managed to survive during the time of Mubarak and also before him. So in that regard, they've got kind of a head start. If there are elections in 6 months, they will get rewards from their organization over the years, more so than perhaps even their numbers should require within Egypt. And I think that's completely natural and expected. I would suspect that they'll get more in the first election than they'll get in the second,
mm-hmm.
Because it's still early on. And depending on when the elections take place and how long other political parties are given to found themselves and organize, I think those will have votes taken away from them as well. I also want to sort of bring up another interesting point, that the Muslim Brotherhood itself is not a monolithic, unified organization.
Of course.
It is an organization that has different wings to it,
mm-hmm.
And those wings may or may not survive as one organization.
Mm-hmm.
We're waiting to see what happens, because in
right.
the Mubarak era, they have a common enemy.
Mm-hmm.
During the
right.
post-Mubarak era, this may not be the case at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we do know that younger members of the movement are going to go on protest next month in March against some of the elders in their organization, because they don't quite like the way that the organization is working out for a variety of reasons. We also know that there are other options for people who previously would have associated themselves with the Brotherhood, because it was sort of the only show in town besides Hosni Mubarak's political
right,
party.
Like the primary resistance to Mubarak.
Yeah, but as mm-hmm. in, my point is that there will be other parties, and there will
right.
be other forums where people can say, okay, I'm not with Mubarak, but I'm also not with the Muslim Brotherhood. What's my third option? And there'll be a third, fourth, fifth, and probably, you know, all sorts of options that will be open to people. And they've already started. One political party has already been recognized. It tried to seek recognition before Mubarak fell. Finally got recognition, I think, a day or so afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the Wasat party,
okay.
which is actually formed as a response almost to the Muslim Brotherhood by one of its former members, and the Wasat party has both Copts as well as Muslims within its ranks and its leadership,
even
great. Though it is started by a member of by a former member of the Muslim Brotherhood. So you see that it's not as simple as talking about a singular influence from a single a monolithic group. It's a mm-hmm. far more complex question than that. And I personally question if the Brotherhood has been given too much attention over the last few weeks.
Certainly.
It's certainly the bogeyman that Hosni Mubarak used to scare everybody with, including mm-hmm. within Egypt. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that it's something that people really buy anymore. They will almost definitely have a role in the coming elections. They made it very clear that they don't want to run any candidate for president, mm-hmm. and they don't seek a majority within parliament. And there were some reports about them not asking for ministerial posts. We'll see how that all works out, but they are a pragmatic organization mm-hmm. more than anything else.
And a civil society organization.
Yeah, I mean, well, at the moment, they are applying for permission to become a political party as mm-hmm. well.
Right.
In order to run under that sort of banner in the elections, but they're not a party that is driven primarily at this stage by ideology,
right.
but by pragmatism. Mm-hmm. That could change. That could very mm-hmm. easily change, as it does with a number of different political movements. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, their key consideration is pragmatism.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that is why they were very careful, very cautious. To get involved in this at all, and they only did so when they thought that, you know, the tide was really changing. They weren't mm-hmm. leading the change at all,
mm-hmm.
and people know that.
Right, and something you mentioned that's quite important is that there was a common enemy throughout the protests. There was a lot of solidarity in resistance to that common enemy, but do you anticipate that now that that common enemy, Mubarak, is deposed, do you anticipate divisions among, you know, all of the people who were rallying against a common enemy?
Do you mean within the Brotherhood or just
no,
in general?
This
is very likely, mm-hmm. and I don't think that is something to be too worried about, though.
Mm.
And I think it's natural in any uprising against any regime, whether a peaceful uprising or a violent uprising or even a change of government. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You see those differences within the Democrat Party in the United States
right.
when they sort of rallied people to vote against the Republican Party.
Right.
The Democrats are no more monolithic than anybody else. And for them, their common enemy was indeed the Republican Party.
Right.
But once the dust is settles and they see that they have different interests and they decide whether or not they want to pursue those interests as part of a united party
mm-hmm.
Or not. And you also have others who form coalitions in order to take forward a national objective. And once that national objective has been achieved, then the coalition falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. I'm sure that there will be differences of opinion. I think that's only natural within a society as diverse and as large as Egypt. But, you know, they've earned the right to be able to make those decisions for themselves now.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've spoken a lot about, you know, the role of Islam and Christianity in these movements. But a lot of, you know, especially the youth who initiated the protests in Egypt, I know are somewhat secular. And, you know, can you speak a bit about the role of secularism? I know it wasn't such an ideological form of secularism, but how do you anticipate that playing out as Egypt?
That's very early to say because, mm-hmm. as you say, there wasn't really an ideology behind any of this.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a secular revolution. It wasn't a religious revolution. It was an
mm-hmm.
Egyptian revolution.
Right.
And all parts of Egyptian society could be seen in Tahrir Square.
Mm-hmm.
All parts.
Right.
So you and what was beautiful about it was that you saw all parts rubbing shoulders with each other and not getting tense.
Right.
So you saw Christians and you saw Muslims. You saw religious and you saw non-religious. You saw the woman in niqab with a full face veil, and you
mm-hmm.
saw women in, you know, short sleeve t-shirts.
Mm-hmm.
You saw holding hands.
Mm-hmm.
You saw men and you saw women. You saw old and you saw young. You saw rich and you saw poor. All sectors of Egyptian society were very much present within Tahrir
mm-hmm.
Square.
Yeah, what was most surprising to me was the class solidarity in Tahrir Square.
Especially in somewhere like Egypt, where
mm-hmm.
there is a huge discrepancy between those different classes. There's a very, very, very rich elite in this country,
yes. mm-hmm.
And there's also a very, very poor majority in this country. So something like 40% of the population exists just above or just below, depending on who you ask, the poverty line, you know, the international poverty line. And then you have an extremely wealthy elite, as I mentioned. But all of these groups were very much united in Tahrir Square. And that's something that was extremely striking, very surprising to many observers, including people within the square. But it was something that came very naturally and wasn't pushed by any ideological standpoint at all. I mean, you would walk into the square and people would be saying things like, peace, 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 i.e., you know, come in peacefully, we're doing this peacefully, we're not going to do this violently, no weapons, etc., etc., etc. That didn't come from any ideological non-violence kind of, you know, standpoint. That just came from, you know, Egyptians being Egyptians. There were people holding up signs saying that cleanliness is of faith, which is a prophetic report from the Prophet of Islam. Now, that was, you know, an exhortation to making sure that the square stayed clean. But, you know, those sorts of things are very commonly said all around Egypt all the time, just as part of, you know, Egyptian culture.
Right.
You know, almost like a proverb, as it were. So you could argue that there was a religious sentiment to it, but Egyptians are, you know, by and large, are people of faith. You know, they may not be very pious or very, very observant, but they are people of faith. So you saw the very quote-unquote secular Egyptian Muslims very active in Tahrir Square, but praying, you know, every day, five times a day. You saw a lot of them doing that. Not all of them, but you saw a lot of them doing that. You saw a lot of the very sort of hip Coptic Christians doing exactly the same thing on Sundays. You know, I mean, it's Egypt is a religiously aware and committed society in terms of their affiliations. That doesn't always translate into, you know, very, very strict observances. And it also definitely doesn't always translate into support for religious political parties, whether those that are inspired by the Coptic community or by the Muslim community.
And I know that you've recently returned from a trip to California in which you were getting some questions from Americans about the situation in the Middle East. And one point that is quite interesting is sort of perceptions of religiosity from the American perspective. I think there's a way that we can misconstrue certain you know, practices as, oh, this must be very religious, or this is a theocratic display, whereas I know from spending quite a bit of time in Egypt that there's almost sometimes religious phrases, even like Allahu Akbar, are almost reflexive. It's just part of the fabric of society.
Very much so. And I think that this was also very clear within the protests. You did see people who were defending themselves against thugs in Tahrir, who would have used slogans like that. And they didn't do so out of some sort of, you know, hyper religiosity that they suddenly want to convert the world or, you know, invade another country or something like that, you know, whatever the stereotypes happen to be right now. But simply, as you said, you know, a reflexive kind of thing that emanates from them being committed to a religious tradition. And this is just Egypt. Egypt is like that. In the same way, by the way, that you will see the women who cover their faces completely use exactly the same religious expressions in their day-to-day lives as the women who don't cover themselves at all and run around in shorts on the beaches or bikinis. You know, if you ask them, how are you, they're going to say, praise be to God, I'm fine. You know, these are exactly the same expressions that, you know, deeply religious, pious, observant, or whatever label we choose to use, people will use within Muslim society in Egypt. This is
and
very,
the same
very
in Christian society also.
Absolutely.
I mean, people will say,
absolutely. This is very common within this society. It's a society that is very aware of its religious traditions, not necessarily translating that into deep pious observance, but very much connected to it. Very much connected to it.
And
across
could you
the board.
Go ahead. across the
board.
I was just going to ask for you to share more from your trip to California and the kinds of questions that you got and the kinds of responses that you gave.
So California was very interesting because on the one hand, through all of the different talks and speeches that I gave while I was in the Bay Area, I could see that there were really two sorts of impressions of what was happening in Egypt and in the wider region. The first was extremely positive and sort of a recognition of what the human spirit is able to actually achieve. You know, it was a very human kind of story in that regard to a lot of people that I met who viewed, wow, I mean, if people in Egypt who have been living under this dictator for 30 years can do this in order to change their society for the better, then what does that say about, you know, all of humanity who don't operate under the same sort of restrictions and still have problems that they need to sort out? So I think it was a very positive response that I got when talking about the revolution, when talking about Tahrir Square in particular, and a very emotional one as well. I spoke to Egyptian expatriates, Egyptian Americans that are in the United States, and they got extremely emotional, obviously, about it. I think a lot of Arab Americans as well, but also people who had no relationship whatsoever to the Arab world at all, getting very, very emotional about how they felt about what was going on. And that was one aspect of it, and I think that was the majority kind of feeling about it. But there were also feelings that I saw expressed by people who felt, you know, a great deal of concern about what was going on. So I met one lady who is nominally Jewish, who is very much a supporter of the State of Israel, who admitted to me she felt very conflicted about the story as it unfolded on her television screens. A very decent lady, a very honorable lady, who really wanted to feel that this revolution was something brilliant and glorious for humanity at large, and at the same time couldn't quite shake this nagging feeling she had within herself that it might not be the best ending, the story's ending, that is, for the State of Israel in the region. And I could understand where she was going with that, because this is obviously something that's been brought up in the American press quite a lot over the past few weeks, that what does the Egyptian revolution, what does the Tunisian revolution, what does the Libyan uprising mean for the State of Israel, which is obviously the United States, you know, most closely aligned partner in the region. There were also other people who questioned how peaceful and pluralistic this uprising in Egypt actually was, and using Israel as a test of that. So if the Egyptians really are about coexistence between Muslim and Christian, and coexistence is such a deeply held you know, belief within Egypt, then that must obviously mean that they're going to be quicker to, you know, make peace with Israel once the dust settles. And I mean, obviously there is a legal state of non-war, I put it, between Egypt and Israel, but the populations of Egypt and Israel are certainly not friends. I found that to be very interesting, because I actually see the situation quite differently, looking at how people on the streets of Cairo and just generally public opinion in the region views the situation in the wider Middle East, particularly with regards to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, as a result of this uprising. And I think that it's really actually an opportunity for the Israelis, more than anything else, to grab peace by the horns.
In expressing solidarity with the protesters, or
I think so, but there's also going to be some sort of mea culpa in terms of how they've dealt with the region as a whole since, because obviously Hosni Mubarak was Israel's preferred ally for many, many years, and even during the uprising, Israel was very clearly behind Hosni Mubarak, and it wasn't until the very few last days where there were statements from Israeli politicians saying, you know, the Egyptian people have to make this decision for themselves. But there's a lot of bad blood between the Egyptian people and Israel as a state, for the fact that it did support Hosni Mubarak for so long, as well as its relationship with the Palestinian people. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, I think that there will be an interesting relationship that takes place. I don't think that there's going to be war, and I've said mm-hmm. this before, but I do think that there will be a changing of the relationship in some way, and it's a change that I think Israel as a whole can actually embrace in a certain mm-hmm. way, if it decides to.
So you see this as an opportunity for Israel to have a more functional and stable relationship with Egypt, or even in the between the populations, between Egyptians and Israelis, like more so on the ground.
I think both, but I also think on a wider level with the whole region, because there isn't. There are peace agreements with different states in the region, but they're not peace agreements with the peoples of those countries, mm-hmm. And they're not incredibly stable relationships. I think that there's a great opportunity here, actually, for Israel to be able to find a place for itself in a wider democratic Middle East, where the people are far more in control of how their governments behave, that will actually ensure its continued prosperity in the Middle East, but it will require very serious steps to be taken. Because at the moment, the way that Israel is perceived throughout this region is not particularly very good at all, and very closely linked to the old regimes.
Right.
And this is entirely separate from the Palestinian question, which is something that I think weighs very heavily on the populations of this region. But if we completely neglect that for a moment, then there's also this identification with Israel as the backer of some of these dictatorial regimes, mm-hmm. because they did support people like Mubarak being in power. And that sort of impression is very live mm-hmm. around some mm-hmm. of these populations, particularly in Egypt. So this wasn't this obviously wasn't a revolution aimed at Israel at all. It was aimed at Hosni Mubarak.
Right.
But you could see that people were very clear about the fact that they didn't view Hosni Mubarak as serving their interests, but serving the interests of others, whether a particular elite within Egypt, or the security considerations of actors outside of Egypt. And I know that that on the streets of Cairo and in the protests, while people weren't vocalizing that very often because that wasn't foremost on their minds, they were vocalizing it. And they would often identify those foreign actors as being the United States and mm-hmm. Israel.
Right. I was going to ask about, has there been a similar sentiment of, well, the United States has been quite a supporter of Hosni Mubarak, and
absolutely.
A sense of betrayal about that. And
Well, it's been a mixed sort of feeling because obviously the election of President Barack Obama was something that gave a lot of Egyptians and just the wider Arab and Muslim world a lot of hope for a change in the relationship between the Muslim world and the Arab world and the West, mm-hmm. Or particularly in particularly with the United States. There was a great disappointment that President Obama didn't come out more strongly in support of the protesters very early on. It was perceived here as being very uncourageous, extremely, almost pussyfooted around, things that that they wouldn't have dreamed would be the case. They thought that they would have a friend in Barack Obama very, very early on. But the White House, for a variety of reasons, I suppose, were extremely reluctant to come out in full force, from the get-go, mm-hmm. which I suppose is just the nature of politics. But that certainly disappointed people. Having said that, even people who were disappointed were very, very easily moved by the statements that President Obama made after the fall of Hosni Mubarak, mm-hmm. Where he lauded the spirit of the Egyptian people very, very highly. One activist I spoke to said it gave me goosebumps.
One of the Egyptian activists.
One of the Egyptian activists told me that it gave him goosebumps to hear President Barack Obama of the United States speak so glowingly about Egypt and about Egyptians. So the goodwill exists, and I don't think that it's irreparable at all. I think there was mostly disappointment rather than betrayal, even though, I know that American commentators have been calling for the administration for a very long time, even before the election of President Obama, for more of a direct policy to encourage democratization within the Arab world. And they've been disappointed at the small steps that they perceive President Obama and his administration doing. Having said all of that, this isn't a country that I think is indelibly anti-American. On the contrary, just on a grassroots kind of level, the amount of hospitality and friendliness that is shown to American tourists and American nationals resident in Egypt, and there are many of them. There are many thousands of Egyptians, and not just Egyptians of Egypt, not just Americans of Egyptian origin, but American nationals from the United States who have no connection with this country whatsoever, but have decided to live here for a variety of reasons. Right. There's a great deal of hospitality towards them and a great deal of warmth towards them. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's evident to anybody who really comes to Egypt. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. This hasn't become a country where xenophobia has suddenly reared its ugly head. And I think that that's something that the United States in general can take great heart in, that the country remains an open, pluralistic society, even more so than it was under Hosni Mubarak.
Mm-hmm. So I'd love to hear more. You spoke about the excitement in the emotional engagement among Americans about this just wonderful display of human spirit. And you mentioned that this actually, made Americans, that people that you were speaking with in California reflect on what that might mean, that kind of human spirit might mean for people who aren't in such repressive regimes. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
Well, I was shocked to find that when I landed in the Bay Area, I left Egypt a few days after Mubarak fell. So I was there throughout, and then I arrived into San Francisco, and found that my academic colleagues who had arrived from Wisconsin were telling me that their governor had been dubbed Mubarak by protesters in Wisconsin who were fairly unhappy with some policies that he was enacting or support of. I don't think that they were thinking about overthrowing him or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But it gave people a certain sense of pride in just the human capacity to do, very, very miraculous things. And I think that that's something that is shared across the world, that, mm-hmm. Egyptians have shown the world that it's possible to not actually keep to the way the things are without having to make things worse. And that strikes me as a very important message that people around the world can buy into very easily and want to buy into. They want mm-hmm. to buy into it. So, and you saw this, clearly in other Arab countries after it took place, which is natural because, Egypt is an Arab mm-hmm. country, so they would naturally have that affinity. But you also saw it in countries that were much further away who were inspired by what happened in Egypt. Not because they wanted to overthrow their governments, but because they thought, wow, these people can do miraculous things. So you could see how it inspired commentators, for example, in places as far away in Malaysia, who talked about, wow, the coexistence that was shown on the streets of Cairo and particularly in Tahrir Square, what can we learn from that as we, move and forge ahead with forging a very pluralistic and diverse society in Malaysia. You saw how people around the world were really looking at it and thinking, well, Egyptians have really shown us not just what they can do, but what we can do as well. And I think it also meant something in terms of shattering perceptions. If you talk to most people pre January 25th, and you ask them about the relationship between Muslims and violence, or Arabs and violence, mm-hmm. then the correlation is very, very clear in the minds of many people around the West and as well as around the world. That's been shattered as, you know, a certain perception completely, and I think forever, because they've seen how people of Arab backgrounds actually, crazily enough, are not, you know, the most violent people around. They can actually do things very peacefully. And people of religion, and of the Muslim religion in particular, are also not people that have to behave violently in order to express their dissent. On the contrary, they showed us as Westerners a better way to express dissent than perhaps any other revolution in history. So I think that that's really shattered perceptions for an incredible amount of people. And it's been interesting to see how that's played out and how the media has covered these stories, and how it's really changed how people think about this region. And to be fair, it's also changed about how people in the region think about themselves. One of the reasons why Hosni Mubarak remained in power for so long was because the people of Egypt really couldn't fathom that change could come without it being incredibly violent and a very chaotic sort of situation. As the days of the protest continued, they gradually began to believe that actually maybe that wasn't a foregone conclusion, and just maybe, people could do it.
Right, and you mentioned media coverage, and I think that one thing about the American media coverage of the Egyptian protests was very much celebrating this solidarity between classes and between Muslims and Christians, but yet, you know, in the coverage of Libya, of course, because that's what's happening, it's a very brutal and violent uprising. And so how, you know, putting those two images of uprising in the Middle East in contrast, has the Libyan revolution in some ways dampened that spirit of excitement over Egypt?
I don't think so, at least not what I saw within... I mean, I went to California and I also went to the UK on my way back to Cairo. And I don't think it's dampened the sense of excitement at all, primarily because universally Muammar Gaddafi is reviled as a man who has essentially lost control in reality, I mean, to put it very bluntly. So they essentially see the violence as his fault, and that the Libyan people are defending themselves. They're not aggressors in this at all. And that's actually very true. And I think you can see that in how the protests began and how they escalated as a result of the regime, not as a result of people becoming impatient in the protests. So I don't think that that's the case at all. I think, on the contrary, people view Egypt and Tunisia as having been examples of very peaceful revolutions when the regimes know that their time is up and it's time to pack up and go home, and Libya as the case where a regime simply refuses to accept that history will no longer allow them to remain, and they're willing to die and take their whole country with them if necessary. I think that there's been universal support actually for the people of Libya as they've risen up against Gaddafi and his regime, because they know that there's no turning back. I can't fathom any commentator or politician worth any, you know, degree of political salt at all coming out and saying something like, well, you know, maybe the protesters should just go home and accept Muammar Gaddafi. The Italian foreign minister said something fairly similar to that, in that he tried to whip up this whole fear about how Libya under a new regime would be an Islamic Arab emirate on the borders of Europe. He was universally derided by all sorts of people from around the region, but also around the West, who regarded such statements to be completely detached from reality, and a betrayal of the spirit of, you know, the human condition that has been so evident across the region, and just really belonging to, you know, a past era where people, you know, drum up the bogey of, you know, the angry bearded Arab Muslim
right.
who simply cannot be trusted to rule himself, and demands that that in order for us to have peace and stability in our world, that strongmen who pay no attention to human rights must be placed as overlords over them in order to make sure
mm-hmm.
that, you know, these, you know, excuse the expression, but, you know, house these Arabs are kept in
mm-hmm.
line.
Right, it's sort of a shattering this paternalistic.
Very
view.
Much so, and it's a
yeah.
it's a paternalistic instinct that is shared by both people in the regimes as well as people who supported them outside. So Hosni Mubarak
mm-hmm.
continuously referred to himself as, you know, the father, right? And you saw how people in Egypt responded very, very angrily to that sort of suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
He's not the father. He's not our father. He's the president, and as the president, he's there to serve our interests, not to make
mm-hmm.
us serve his.
Right.
And that was very, very clear, I think, in how people responded to that. You also see that in how, unfortunately, a lot of the commentary has gone in recent years about democracy in the Middle East, that, you know, whenever that was really talked of as a legitimate foreign policy objective for whether the United States or my own country, the United Kingdom, the fear of what Arabs would actually do with democracy was always brought up. And
right.
the implicit and sometimes explicit assumption was that it would be bad for the West.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that still continues. I mean, I saw
right.
very racist, bigoted commentary within the UK as well, that essentially, you know, claimed that to raise questions about the Arab ability to build democracies and rule themselves was not a racist or bigoted thing to do, but very natural and a legitimate sort of fear. And I could only describe such things as incredibly racist and bigoted, flying right in the face of what is actually happening in front of us right now.
Right.
But this is unfortunately part of the thinking that I think very, very much defined how many Western foreign policies have dealt with the region for quite a long time. This also comes out of a particular history, but it's a time that I think its time is now past.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that nobody will really buy that anymore now that they've
mm-hmm.
seen that people in this region are capable of responding with force if they have to defend themselves against something like the regime of Muammar Gaddafi, but also without force when they're able to
yeah.
do so. The biggest difference between Libya and Egypt in this regard was that the forces of the state, the martial forces of the state, would not fire indiscriminately upon the people rising up against the state.
Mm-hmm.
In Libya, the martial forces of the state were willing to do that. And many of them broke away and so on, but, you know, Muammar Gaddafi isn't just himself and a small clique of people and the remnants of a state around him, as was the case with Egypt. It's a very different
right.
sort of situation, but one that I think is fast coming to an end.
Mm-hmm. Well, and another thing that I think has been shattered in these wonderful, or in these uprisings that have been both wonderful and terrible, watching them from an American perspective, is that notion that it would have to be the United States who would establish democracy. It would have to be, we're moving on from the regime change paradigm of the Iraq War, and
yeah.
we're seeing that people can change regimes, and you know, the people can do that, and it's not an American paternalistic opportunity to promote democracy in the Middle East in the way that it has been for, you know, decades.
Well, I know a lot of other commentators have, you know, sort of brought that up. I question
mm-hmm.
the the utility of that kind of analysis, only because Saddam Hussein would be comparable more with someone like Gaddafi rather than Hosni Mubarak. So I suspect that if the Iraqi population as a whole, as opposed to just the Kurds in the north, had risen up against Saddam Hussein, then he would have taken the country to the brink of hell before he actually stepped down. And we saw that, you know, in the aftermath of the first Gulf War, as a result of American encouragement, you know, a huge portion of the population in the south of Iraq did rise up against Saddam Hussein, expecting the United States to come to their aid and support if they were willing to take their destiny into their own hands. That turned out to be a fatal calculation because Saddam Hussein destroyed them and completely completely brutalized them and put them down in very, very short time. And the United States stood back and allowed it to happen. That's something, by the way, that Iraqis have never forgiven the United States for. So I question whether or not that sort of model of analysis can be widely sort of applied in this region. But having said that, I think that there is that sense from people outside of the region that, okay, we now have options on the table if we want to see democracy in the Arab world. We don't necessarily have to envisage an Iraq scenario if the conditions allow for it. And the conditions did allow for it within Egypt. I suspect that they will also allow, and within Tunisia, and I suspect that they will allow for it in other countries in the region, hopefully in far less of a civil upheaval. And we've seen how different regimes in the region are now taking steps to enact reforms within their societies because they know that the time has come and they can either be a part of the reforming wave or they can be swept away by it. So I think that that's definitely a seismic shift in how the regimes in the region perceive themselves. They know that their legitimacy and continuation is not guaranteed. And I think that that's I think that's actually good for any government. I don't think that any government should feel that they have a constant right to expect themselves to be perceived as legitimate by the people if they don't deliver to support the legitimate hopes of those people. So I think that's very good just anywhere in the world. The difference that will happen here in the Middle East is that you know, people, you know, heads of state may actually start to retire, you know, voluntarily without having to go through civil upheaval at all, or they may enact policies that actually make them incredibly popular with their with their populations. And in those countries where they already are, then they really have nothing to worry about. Think it's the I think it's the rulers and leaders in the Arab world that know that they don't have true popularity with their own people that need to be worried about what's going on. I think those that can honestly look at themselves in the mirror and say, our populations actually want this here. They may not like it us all the time, like any population doesn't necessarily like its government all the time, but they essentially give us legitimacy by positive consent as opposed to negative coercion. Those sorts of regimes don't really have too much to worry about. But the ones that know that actually their time is up and they stand on the other side of history, I think that they have a lot to be worried about. And I think that's why Gaddafi is digging in so hard. I think that members of his entourage or his regime, I think some of them are just quite frankly, you know, removed from this plane of reality. I think that they really believe what they're saying is true, in contradiction to, you know, everything around them. And I think others know that if change comes to Libya, they're done. You know, there will be no role for them in Libya. And I think they know that. So rather than try to come to some sort of agreement with the protesters, they know the protesters will simply not will not allow them to have that kind of role in the mm-hmm. future, no matter what they do, because too much has happened already. So a lot of them mm-hmm. will decide it's either do or die. Mm-hmm. And this is why I'm actually very concerned about what happens in Libya in the coming mm-hmm. days and weeks, because already things have gotten so violent, and mm-hmm. so many people have died. But there is no choice. Somebody has to now win in order mm-hmm. for this to end.
It's reached a point of no return.
It reached a point of no return quite some time ago. Mm-hmm. And if the rebellion is not successful, then I am sure we will see a huge amount of violence against those who participate in the rebellion, mm-hmm. a huge amount of violence. If the rebellion is successful, then I'm hopeful that they will be far better towards the regime than the regime was to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. This has been wonderfully illuminating, and I appreciate this conversation.
No, the pleasure was mine. Thank you very much, and thanks. All of your viewers and the people at Blogging Heads.
Right. Thank you to Blogging Heads. All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks. Bye.